This is episode 16 of the podcast Without a Name.
It is the 16th episode of the podcast Without a Name.
Brought to you by Budweiser and Pall Mall.
And Schmacka. That's what I'm drinking this evening. I'm assuming you're drinking Budweiser, and what was the other one?
Pall Mall is the brand of cigarette that I smoke because I am a spendthrift.
Well, cigarettes are bad for you. Alcohol, on the other hand, is okay. I won't touch it for that one.
Causes cancer too, Joe.
I'm just gonna pretend like I didn't hear that.
La 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 la. Liver, kidney.
I mean, those are all replaceable, right?
All myriad of cancer, Joe, caused by alcohol.
Way to be Debbie Downer. Well, you know
cigarettes
what?
Cigarettes tend to, you know, just affect the lungs.
Well, we're all living to die anyway, let's be real. So, you know, whatever. YOLO.
Hope I die before I get old. That's what Roger Daltrey said.
Oh, wait a minute. Hold on a second.
This is CNN breaking news.
Anthony is not here. In case you did not know, Anthony is not here. It's breaking.
And he's colluding with the Russians, which we will not talk about at all tonight.
Collusion.
Collusion confusion, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, I almost played it again. Anyway, speaking of collusion, I don't want to get into Trump-Russia, although it is our reoccurring segment. We won't get into it, but collusion. I'm just going to pose this, and we're just going to move on to the other topics. What is collusion?
Colluding. It's like you're in cahoots.
And is it illegal? Is it a legal standard? Okay, we'll just pose that for our listeners. Think about this for a minute. Just think about that, and maybe another episode when we're talking about it, we could talk about it more. Anyway, so tonight we're going to talk about... Yes, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, put a pin in it.
Put a pin in it. We're going to put a pin in that. That'll be another episode. Maybe we'll do it on a live broadcast or something. We'll talk about that. But tonight we're going to talk about the opioid epidemic. We're going to talk about the immigration reform proposal from the Trump White House. And then we have a case study, if Anthony shows up, which he might show up. We have a little case study that I call Illogical Debate. I'm going to come up with a more formal name for it because I think it'll end up being fun. Anyway, if we don't do that, we'll probably talk about things like maybe the wage gap or the Harvard discriminating in admissions and things like that. So there's a bunch of stuff on the plate. How do we jump into this? Let's do the opioid epidemic. I mean, I think this is a topic which I think most people who are listening to this probably can say has touched their lives in some way, shape, or form. I know for us, that for sure, we were just talking pre-cast about our high school mates who've all passed away based on some sort of opioid overdose or something of that nature. And I know Rich has a little bit of a past, but I mean, is it an epidemic first, right? And what can we do about it? What does the federal government have to do about it? Is it local? Who has the big role in this? Is this really big pharma, you know, shoving it down our throats? You know, we have some statistics to look at and go over, and yeah, let's get going. What do you think about the opioid?
Well, now I know that doctors, and it's probably at the behest of pharmaceutical companies and the government and local authorities, they're taking steps now to they're curbing their prescription of opioids. They're prescribing them, but they're not prescribing them for like 90 days or 60 days or something like that, like they were before, which was a big problem. Like, you know, bottom line, you get walking pneumonia, you got pain in your chest. You don't need a 90-day prescription of Percocet to deal with that. But that's kind of was what was getting doled out. And so that's one thing that's definitely happening. I mean, that's word on the street. That's boots on the ground. That's actually going on. I know when I worked in the hospital as an aide and when I was in nursing school, I saw a lot of people that, you know, were regular people that got addicted to painkillers because of chronic pain issues. Mm-hmm. or because they had something like a shoulder injury where a doctor overprescribed them something and then they got hooked and then they moved on to hard drugs. I was a drug user at one point in my life. Never had an injury or anything like that. Never was prescribed. Well, I mean, I've been prescribed opiates, but that wasn't what kind of caused me to go off the rails there. But so I kind of have a view from multiple angles, I guess you could say. I've had several friends die from overdoses. I have friends that overdose and live, thank God.
Yeah.
And they're some of them are getting sober. Some of them, you know, are just, you know, just not doing drugs anymore, still drinking and stuff. But
yeah.
Anyway, yeah, it's definitely a thing. It's definitely real. It's definitely a problem. I think, again, the overprescribing was something that really had much to do because doctors are treating people like customers instead of patients. So people are telling doctors what they want. They're going to the doctor and saying, hey, man, I twisted my ankle the other day. I think you need to write me a script for Oxy or not Oxy, Percocet. You know, yeah. They're like, oh, OK, like, you know,
sure,
you're going to stay my patient
pain,
if I do that.
They're pain management to a whole nother level.
Pain management. And then you have the other, you know, level of people that actually get hurt and they get prescribed something. And then, you know, just it could be a chronic pain condition, like a herniated disc or something like that. And so what happens with them and what I've seen as a medical professional, I guess, if you want to call it a medical professional, is that they start with drugs. You know, they start with Percocet, you know, what are those other Jones? Not Demerol. Whatever. You know, they just start with an opiate. And so they take that, and obviously tolerance builds really quickly. So they get something that's stronger and stronger. And if it's something that's chronic, they don't want to give you medication that contains, in the drug abuser world, we call it APAP, but like Tylenol, ibuprofen. They don't really want to give you that because it destroys like your liver, your kidneys. So they'll give you like Oxycontin or morphine or
I tell you something like that. I am a ibuprofen, like I'm an ibuprofen addict probably. I am like constantly, I was like, oh my God, my head hurts. Oh my God. Like I would not
so
be able to
bad.
Live without
so
ibuprofen.
Bad for your kidneys. Tylenol is actually one of the most toxic drugs to your liver that you can take.
Oh my Lord. I will
if not the most toxic drug.
But anyway, to touch on kind of how, you know, this has impacted me. I too, we both went to the same high school. So we've had a lot of the same high school tragedies with the, what's going on. I do have an uncle who's been in and out of jail, because of heroin addiction. And it's, you know, people are still up in the air as to where he is right now. I mean, we know where he is, but where he is with a possible addiction. I personally think he's probably in a good place, but, you know, this is something that it's hitting everyone. It seems like it really is. Like, I don't think you could really talk to anyone who hasn't had some sort of, you know, this touch them in some way. It's just,
yeah,
it's weird.
And I mean, what happens is, you know, like I said, people take medication, the tolerance builds, they go through their prescription too fast. They can't get it renewed. So what do? They turn to the streets.
Yeah.
And then they're getting stuff like heroin and whatever else they can get on the street. And then that's where, you know, the overdoses and stuff like that occur, because when you're getting stuff off the street, you have no idea. One bag of heroin to another bag of heroin can be like, you know, an aspirin to an Oxy 80 or something like that. It's really can vary in potency. So that's where the danger comes in.
Yeah. And to our listeners out there who are like, well, the few listeners we have that are like, you know, you see, obviously you see this on CNN, you see this on all the major news outlets, you know, the opioid situation. This is probably something that, you know, they're not exaggerating. It's hard to believe. I think that's real. I mean, we're looking at the statistics we were looking at before the show, according to the National Institute of on Drug Abuse, and economists recently put out some statistics too. I mean, we're talking over the last 10 to 15 years, you know, a crazy steady increase of deaths and overdoses, in America. And Something you just brought up actually makes one of these charts make sense. The Economist chart that they have here shows the prescription opioids, heroin, deaths from prescription opioids, heroin, and fentanyl and other synthetic opioids. And I was interested in why they had broken it out like that. And I think what that chart's saying, remember we couldn't, I couldn't figure this out pre-show, is that if you look at the prescription opioid chart and how it goes up, and that started to increase pretty hardcore in the early 2000s, and it's been pretty steady. And what you said was people were trying to get these things legally through whatever reasons, the back hurts, things like that. And then they couldn't get it, so they went to heroin, they go to the streets. Well, maybe the heroin jump in 2009-ish, it looks like, heroin just took off. If you're looking at that chart, it's like a ridiculous jump in heroin deaths. And maybe that's because of the prescription, the lag in that prescription there, right? If you think about in other areas like economics, there's always a lag in policy. You create a policy and X amount of months later, that's when you start seeing economic gains or losses. And it looks like that might be telling a story here. The prescription opioid situation turned into a heroin situation and other, more black market type of situations. And that now that chart makes sense to me looking at it.
And a little more, if it's not really a conspiracy theory, but if you want to go a little deeper into it too, mm-hmm. Our involvement in the Middle East and Afghanistan and stuff, that the heroin production over there, and it's not, I'm not going to go as far as saying it's because of us,
yeah.
But the heroin production from Afghanistan and stuff has skyrocketed since we've destabilized their government, because there's not a police force and so they're pretty much a war zone. So these, drug lords and stuff kind of take over and grow.
They also look for whatever is going to make them money too. When they're extreme poverty there,
Of course.
So this is the only cash crop that they have in many cases. And to the same point you made about, going in destabilizing, I would actually make the argument that now that the Taliban's not in play, that some of these different crops and stuff probably mean that they have a more legal way of actually going about, or not even legal, but hands off, like from a government or authority to be able to be doing this. So maybe it's instability in some sense, but maybe it's more like a hands off from the old Taliban regime and the current regime to suddenly make it so here's something that's going to make us money. And they're just going to put it in overdrive. They're just going to keep making money. There's no one stopping us. The Taliban's not there, skimming money off of us or trying to, or maybe not even letting them. I don't know what Taliban's approach was to that situation. My assumption would be that they were like a mafia with that, where they would let you do it, but they're just making all the money from it. But
I would assume that if they're such a, fundamentalist, drugs
or they wouldn't
like
it.
Not,
yeah. Altogether. Yeah.
Not, that's not part of Islam. You're not even allowed to drink. So,
yeah. So that could be it, right? It could be now that the Taliban's not in charge or whatever, there's instability. But the point is still there regardless that, something may have happened there to increase output from them. And then, you have the prescription opioids and actually looking at this chart a little closer, it's just interesting. I'm just kind of coming through some, interesting trends here. If you look at the opioid, where the heroin jumps off in 2009 and the trend of the prescription opioid, how that goes, the heroin takes off, but the opioids flatline for a few years or they go, sideways and it starts going up again. That would also indicate that heroin started taking over some of that prescription opioid market, meaning people weren't getting them, so they went to the heroin market. And it's just interesting looking at it.
Because once you get addicted to heroin, the only thing like a Percocet is going to do for you is it's going to keep you from getting sick. So once you're hooked on heroin, you need heroin or something stronger than heroin, like fentanyl or something like that.
Yeah.
Once you're addicted to smack, a Percocet is like a laughable thing. It's like, all right, yeah, what's this going to do to me? It's like a fucking aspirin. It's just going to keep you from withdrawals pretty much. So I can see why that chart reflects that trend.
Yeah, absolutely.
It definitely makes sense to me. As far as the overdose deaths, I think, from the prescription side, I think when doctors overprescribe things, it puts drugs like that in homes. And homes have kids and homes have uncles that root through medicine cabinets and, cousins that root through your shit. And they don't know exactly what it is. They look at the bottle. They're like, oh, shit, this is, I heard about this. This is going to fuck me up, and they might chew up something that they don't even know what it is, and next thing you know, they're
done.
You know, they wait till their parents go to bed. They chew up like a morphine pill, and they're stop breathing on their couch, and their parents come down and find them dead in the morning.
That's another good point because it's not always just about addiction here. I mean, a lot of these stats we're talking about deaths and, you know, overdose and deaths resulting from overdose, but like a lot of people think, oh, it's an addiction. But I would be interested, and I don't know if the stats are there, like the deaths resulting from one-time use. Like or one or less than an addiction, you know, like that, maybe explore.
Yeah, like a little, like a party guy or something.
Yeah,
like that,
you know? Yeah. Someone who might not be addicted, but you know, every Friday night they like to pop a few pills and then chug a few beers or something like that, right? Like those situations. Yeah, I'd be interested to see how many deaths have resulted from that. I know in my past I have at least one friend who died from that type of situation. He wasn't addicted. He was just exploiting them and drinking and. He died, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happens. It's like, oh, I usually take three. And it's like, well, you don't usually take three and drink a pint of Jim Beam.
Yeah.
So it's like when you start mixing things, that's when it represses your respiratory response. And you stop breathing and you die.
But I'm telling you, these charts, these numbers from the, you know, what's this one? The National Institute of Drug Abuse. Again, I keep forgetting their name. NIH. I mean, it's pretty, I mean, this is ridiculous. It's crazy. You just go down across the board. I mean, you're talking 200-300% increase over the last 10 years in these deaths, if not more.
And this
if
is,
not more.
This is a total bipartisan issue. This goes across both sides of the aisle. However, what I think is going to be the dividing point and make it a partisan issue is that Republicans are going to want stiffer sentences and, you know, lock people up, put them in jail, this and that. And I think the Democrats are going to be more like, let's get people help, let's decriminalize stuff, which I'm going to have to agree with them because, and I'm going to pull this thing out before, I think it was in episode 1, actually, I talked about this. Portugal had like a huge heroin epidemic. Like they were people dying in the streets of heroin over in Portugal. And what they did was they decriminalized hard drugs, like they decriminalized heroin. So like you wouldn't get locked up for possession or, you know, anything like that.
Yeah.
And they gave them safe injection sites. They gave them medical treatment instead of jail time. And, you know, the crime rate went down. The deaths from overdoses went down drastically. It all really had a very positive effect.
Yeah.
And I know we're not Portugal, but I think that doing that and regulating it, decriminalizing it, maybe even, I mean, if I want to go crazy libertarian Ron Paul or Rand Paul, I would say legalize it, regulate it, have companies manufacture it so that you know what you're getting. You know the dose you're taking. You know what you're putting in your body.
Yep.
You're not taking elephant tranquilizer mixed with like pancake, you know, batter or something like that. It's what it is. It's listed on the label.
And I agree with you on that. I'm of the same approach. I think you get a better control of it all in this situation. I can't speak for Anthony, but I think he might agree with us on this too, to a certain degree. But yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, something's got to change, right? And looking at the NIH stats too, which is interesting, they threw cocaine in there, the stats for cocaine. I'm assuming it's just to give you a comparison. And if you look at their stats, I mean, cocaine, like if you're wondering what is the epidemic, it's not, you know, it's opioid because cocaine's pretty much just going sideways. Like this is not, you know, it's a problem. We don't want to minimize it, but it's not like cocaine hasn't increased 200-300% over the last 10 years. And so it really kind of solidifies, okay, you know, we need to be focusing on opioid.
It's not a physically addictive drug. It's a mentally or psychologically addictive drug. You don't get physically addicted to cocaine. Like if you're a cocaine addict and you stop taking cocaine, you're not going to get withdrawals and throw up and get diarrhea and this and that. You know, you're just going to feel shitty because you don't have cocaine.
Yeah.
So it's a totally different kind of a thing. Like, you know, people pick that up and put it down all the time. You know, you go to any bar in the Northeast and you're going to find a guy that does a couple lines or whatever every once in a while.
So what do we do about this? How do we go about the? I think we talked about one solution, right? Decriminalizing or legalizing, and controlling.
Absolutely, I think that's really the only solution that I can see that's that would have a really meaningful impact on the whole situation. If you start incarcerating everybody, drugs are so easy to get in jail.
Yeah.
Like you're taking somebody and getting them off the streets and making it like easier for them to get drugs.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
And the other side of this too is limiting or controlling or somehow reining in doctors prescribing certain drugs. That's more of a slippery slope to me, because now that gets into the healthcare debate a little bit. And it also goes, it adds another layer of regulation in a already very heavy regulated industry. But
well, no, I mean, I can speak on that. As a hospital worker, there were people that would come in there, frequent flyers. Mm-hmm. They would always say, oh, I have intractable abdominal pain, or, oh, I have what the fuck is that thing that's like a made up disease?
Oh, I know what you're talking about. My sister probably has it.
That muscular thing.
Yeah.
Fibromyalgia.
Yes, that's one. That one, yeah.
It's like, oh, I got fibromyalgia. And it's like, all right, you can't diagnose it. So you kind of just got to go, oh, he has these symptoms.
Sure,
all right.
Yeah.
So part of it is that it's like the overprescribing and stuff. So you really can't curb some of that. But what you can do is say, hey, if somebody comes in with a broken finger, you're not going to give them 90 days.
But do you want the government to say that, or do you just want that to be an industry practice? You know what I'm saying? Like
Why doesn't the board of, the American Medical Association, whatever, AMA,
okay,
why don't they get out there and say a broken finger does not warrant 90 days of Percocet?
Because we see it with childcare, right? You have your schedule for your different childcare stuff, right? Like and doctors follow that. Like we follow, the prescribed or the recommended, vaccines and all this type of stuff at certain ages. So it really, I think it can be effective for, what did you say, the American, was AMA or something? Is that what it was?
Yeah, the American Medical Association.
So I think that could be effective in saying, here is what we want doctors and physicians following based on our certifications and our studies and stuff like that. So that I think that could be effective because it works in other areas, I think.
And I think you have to stop treating patients as customers and you have to start treating them as patients. You might give them an outcome or tell them something that they don't want to hear, give them a medicine that they don't want, but you're the doctor and they're your patient.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. I mean, stop treating with customers. And, that could also jump into the whole debate of healthcare too on the other end of this. But no, I mean, so we talked about legalization or decriminalizing these situations. Or like we just said, maybe having the industry standards change and stuff like that. I think, and as far as the epidemic side of this, I know declaring it an issue like this, I think, at least NPR is of the opinion that we could get more federal money and stuff to help with treatment and things like that. I don't know if throwing money at it's going to change. I think you need actual different reforms in different areas. Maybe in the short term you might save some lives or, be able to save people in the field when it comes to equipping first responders with particular, what's that medication for?
Narcan
and things like that.
I've been brought back several times, so
yeah,
I can say it's a shitty thing to have like your girlfriend standing over you crying or your mom standing over you crying. You're getting woken up by the paramedics laying on your living room floor. It's not a fun thing. These people aren't bad people.
No.
The drug at what, at some point, I don't know. I guess you would say like, all right, you're a meat eater. Be a vegetarian.
Yeah.
How easy is that?
It's a different thing. Yeah, I agree.
It's not easy. So, and they'll do anything to get the money that they need to get the drug. And, they're not bad people. The drugs cause them to be bad people or display bad characteristics, but they're not bad people. They need help. They don't need to get locked up.
And some of it too is a personality thing. Some people, whether they're, still, growing up and maturing and developing, they do things and they suddenly find a physical addiction because of adolescence or something, when we're talking younger people. Some people, just like we talked about this, everyone kind of has they have their down moments, they have their down times, and to the depth and breadth of those things, could change per person. So could last for a long time for some or a short time. It's people that go through these moments, and you just got to try to survive it, I guess, and hope it's not a major addiction,
And you know what the crazy thing about opiates are? They don't physically alleviate pain. all they do is reduce the psychological response to pain. So that can be emotional pain, that can be anything. That's why they're so attractive. Because when you take a couple Percocets, you don't have a freaking care in the world. You could care less. Your house could be burning down and you're like, oh man, shit, I guess I better go outside right now. Or, you know, you're fighting with your girlfriend. You know, there's more fish in the sea. You could care less about anything.
Yeah.
That's the such, because I think everybody now, I mean, you know, the world, everybody is so stressful. So on top of having physical pain, I think a lot of other people have some kind of emotional or mental issues that are going on too, that have to be addressed. And that's why opiates are so yeah, attractive to people.
So Rich, real quick, we have,
this is CNN breaking news.
This just into the newsroom. Anthony might join the podcast, hopefully here in a minute.
What do you think? Quarter staff.
So let's see if he could jump in, and we will.
This is CNN breaking news.
Anthony has joined the podcast without a name.
Good morning, everybody.
You complete me.
I feel so welcome. I apologize about my tardiness.
Unacceptable. I believe he was shopping somewhere at Kohl's, maybe.
Victoria's Secret.
Victoria's
Tardy
Secret.
Is, I was thinking Kohl's. Not okay. Politically correct. Please say you were slow.
I enjoy Kohl's. I'll rock Kohl's.
I see. I threw Kohl's out there because I recently have enjoyed Kohl's.
I enjoy
St. John's
cars.
Bay, son. Two guns up, St. John's Bay.
What?
Don't choose, bitch.
Well, here we are. So, Anthony.
Only thing about Kohl's is all the immigration.
There's a lot of immigration going on there. People are immigrating through the doors, buying things, and
selling things.
They always get you with those impulse buy racks.
It's like a black market of
Kohl's cash. It's an addiction.
Goddamn Kohl's cash, 20% off.
Yeah, all the time. You got to go on their website. Every time in there, you got to go on their website. They'll be like 20% off.
You
got to get the code.
You know what? If you just go to the register and say, I forgot my
they do it anyway. Yeah.
They'll just put the
thing. I was going to say that.
And if you open up a credit card, you get 35% off.
Anybody that's listening, listen. Your Kohl's cash, your Kohl's coupons, it might have an expiration date on there, but it never expires.
They will not take any
coupon ever. Just push the point. Be like, I didn't know it expired. They will not fight you on that shit.
I mean, not for anything. Do they really care? You know, they're just like, whatever. They got you in a store. You go in. Listen, I might go in to spend like $15 at Kohl's. I'll have 30% off and still somehow spend like $300. Like, they get you in there. You leave. But I go in for a shirt. I come out with like shoes, Calphalon pots and pans and a candle and maybe a new pillow and a bed, possibly a new house. I don't know. You get
Ooh,
a lot
there's
of
a juicer.
This is a great topic.
Yeah. Boy, I feel like I need this kind of.
This is a great topic after our opioid conversation.
Yeah.
It's an addiction, right? I mean, so Anthony was in for the addiction and opioid situation, but we're going to move on. I'm sure he has some great thoughts on that, but we'll get him another day. We're going to talk about immigration reform.
Immigration.
I'm sure that's on top of everyone's mind.
Yeah. I come from immigrants.
So Trump recently introduced his reform. He's calling it the RAISE Act? Is that what it's called?
RAISE.
Yeah, RAISE.
Raise them up.
RAISE.
It's a point system for legal immigration. So not to be confused with illegal immigration. I wouldn't imagine there'd be policy for that because it's illegal. But I don't know. There's a lot of people who don't like it. A lot of people who like it. I mean, it's not going to go through in its current state because that's just this proposal and it's going to get hacked at and it might not even go anywhere considering Republicans don't want to do anything in Congress anyway. So, but, you know, I know Rich had an opinion on this, but we were running down to different
sections, if you will. Yeah, I think it's one of Trump's most well thought out and well-intentioned proposals.
So Stephen Miller, I bet, is the architect for this. So he's like an immigration guru, from what I understand. You know, the one who was going, Jim. And the cosmopolitan bias. Well,
you're talking nuts, Jim.
I wonder if that's real. I meant to look that up.
Soldering iron.
So I got to be honest with you. I'm somewhat confused about the overall, you know, idea of the Raise Act. I mean, so I understand that the premise of it, but what are we trying to achieve exactly? Like, are we?
It's based on a point system, and there is, so he gives points for the higher education. If you're in a STEM field, you get higher points. Your English proficiency, you get higher points. So everyone's fixated on the English thing, by the way. If you have a job offer, you get a certain amount of points. If you're a Nobel Prize winner, if you're an Olympian.
Because I guess where my confusion comes in is our education system versus the education system of other countries is pretty different, right? So, you know, What might be considered a college education in another country might not.
So it does differentiate between domestic or U.S. Degrees versus foreign ones. And I think it also talks about whether it's a recognized accreditation or something in the U.S. So there is some nuance there with that. I think ultimately, listen, Trump was would argue that the point of this is to have legal immigration of people who are going to come here and be productive members of our society, and you know, which also means attributing to our economy, right? So it's heavy on, you know, kind of 20 to 40 year olds with job offers, higher education, a good proficiency in English, and have already have a stable coming from. Pretty much already some sort of stable background, essentially, it's saying, or you're kind of so like, you know, an Olympian or a Nobel Prize winner, you know, someone who's probably very well educated, or an authority in their industry or something like that. And then they also talk about the spouses and the family. I think the spouse thing is pared down. I think I believe it's only allowed to be immediate family members now, as opposed to more extended family members. Like, actually, immediate family members would also include parents. So I don't even think it includes parents anymore. I think it's just like wife and kids or husband and kids. So
I guess what I'm worried about is, you know, so you're basically leaving it up to our government to decide what a lower skilled immigrant is versus a higher skilled immigrant is, right? I mean, like that's what we're looking at is skill base, right?
So,
like,
I would imagine that's the
concrete measurables, though. I mean, I don't.
Well,
think
the, like, sure, but you know, one of the things that I look at is, you know, when my parents came to this country, like they weren't really skilled, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But they were still, you know, they became very, you know, good citizens and contributed to our economy very well. You know what I mean? Yeah. So like, you know, they were, you know, what I guess this Raise Act is hoping to achieve by bringing people in like them. Mm-hmm. However, they would have been looked at, I guess, at the time as uneducated in terms of what we're considering educated. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Lower skilled, didn't know the language, you know, type of situation. So it's kind of like, is this filtering out certain things that shouldn't be filtered out yet?
You know what I mean? I don't think so. And I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know your dad. I've met him a few times. But
so you're saying you hate my dad, Rich? Is that what you're saying?
Your dad is a really good guy. I remember him blowing a whistle at a hockey game. That was pretty awesome. But he had a skill. Like when he came here, right? I mean, he laid bricks, did concrete, did stuff like that. So like he had a measurable thing that he could do to support himself.
You know, when he first came here, you know, basically because he didn't know the language and he was skilled in his own right. However, when you compare that to what like a similar skill to that would have been here, he would have been unskilled. You know what I mean? Like, so, you know, a bricklayer in a small town in Italy versus a bricklayer in, you know, United States.
Let's use, I mean, if you don't mind, let's use your dad as a little bit of a case study. How old was your dad when he came to America?
He was 19 years old.
So 19, that would have put him at the 6 points, but better than most of the older people. The best points would be 30 to 10 or 26 to 30.
He couldn't speak English when he came.
So no English proficiency at all.
His brother lived here. His brother lived here already. Okay. So he did have a family member here.
How about education?
education. So that's kind of one of the things that I'm curious about, because, you know, in terms of what my dad will talk about, he, you know, was in post-secondary school mm-hmm. there. So completed some college, but they did things differently over there, especially at that time. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
You know, being in the seminary was part of their normal, you know, they would go to the seminary for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. They would go to college for a couple of years. And this was all considered, you know, college. It wasn't really like a formal, you know, university like thing that we have now here.
Would he have,
you know what I mean?
Would he be considered some sort of bachelor's degree?
No.
So foreign bachelors would have gotten him 5 points. U.S. bachelors get you 6 points. So it's only one point different.
So he would have got zero on that.
But he would you get 1 point for a high school diploma.
I mean, did being in the seminary in Italy have anything, have any points to that? You know what I mean? Like that.
Yeah, unless it would be the equivalency of a bachelor's degree in Italy.
Right.
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 So he wouldn't have got anything on that. English ability, almost nothing. Did he have a job offer or anything like that? Probably not. Right.
No. He ended up coming here working for a 7-Up company, actually. Ooh. as a general maintenance guy. Because, you know, a couple of his other Italian buddies were in there. That was the only job he could get without speaking the language at the time.
And as much as I think your dad is awesome, did he win a Nobel Peace Prize? Or a Nobel Prize in general?
Although I believe he would be totally capable of doing so.
Okay.
He has never won a Nobel
Prize
of any sort.
An Olympian.
He is banned from Twin Rinks of Pensauken.
He was banned at Twin Rinks of Pensauken.
Yeah. And I'm going to take it he's not an Olympian, right? So, and he had a family member, investors. So if there's some sort of investor, there's some... I mean, your dad would probably have scored low on this.
Yeah, he would have been very low. However, he ended up becoming
because he became middle class.
Here's the thing. Like, so people came to America, you know, especially in that time. I'm not sure how it works now. I mean, my dad came here, you know, so long ago, you know, mm-hmm. it was 40 something years ago, you know.
Was it the late 60s like that he came or like
he came here in, I guess it was 1970 or yeah, like it was probably 70 or 71 ish. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah. Understand it was a different time. So I get all that, you know what I mean? But, you know, a big reason why a lot of people came to the United States from certain countries was because, you know, they were go-getters and they had an opportunity here.
Yeah.
And you know, so they didn't actually have an opportunity here. They viewed America as a place of opportunity. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, I have, you know, all this skill or this mind frame that I feel that I have, mm-hmm. But I have no way to outlet it, you know, in my current country. I want to go somewhere that, you know, gives me, you know, the American dream. I have that potential to become, you know, what I'm capable of becoming.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in that case, though, it's kind of like, you know, we talk about it all the time with people that are in, you know, university level and they graduate college and they can't find a job because they don't have any work experience, mm-hmm. you know, and they're like, well, I don't have enough work experience because I just came out of college. You know what I mean? So like, how do I get a job if I don't have any work experience? And, you know, back and forth, it becomes like a catch-22. And I feel like this is kind of similar, is like, well, you know, I don't have any of the skills and stuff like that I want to build in America that gives you the opportunities to do so because I haven't lived there yet. You know what I mean? So it doesn't really give that opportunity, I guess, to start. I mean, obviously there's a bad side of that, which we've seen in, you know, all of our history, I guess, with immigration. But, you know, on the other end, it does filter out certain people that are coming here for the correct reason, which is to try to follow the American dream and try to achieve that, you know, because they see it as an opportunity to better themselves and their family. You know what I mean?
And that's the problem with that is, it's just when you try to implement those type of things into immigration policy is how do you really measure that? You know, it's hard, right. You know, and I think, let's give Trump the benefit of the doubt. I think he thinks he's trying to capture that type of thing, but what he's doing is he's cutting out some of the growth area, right? Like you have, when you think about investment, right? You have growth, and you have income, and you have all the different ways of investing your money with based on different risk portfolios, which have different, you know, levels of income that, or not income, but profit that you get from it. And the best place where you make money in the financial markets is growth in developing worlds, right? Mm-hmm. So what I think he's doing here is he's shooting more for the income, which would be that more stable, you know, Fortune 500, high cap stocks in the financial world. Whereas you might want to be investing in South America if you want growth, you know, like people, you know, just developing countries, you know, these countries that are, you know, finally coming into their own and industrializing and things like that. I think he's trying to get to something. I think he might be trying to get to what your parents, your father was or is or whatever, yeah. But he might be being too specific.
Interestingly enough, this seems to be a very well thought out plan. I mean, I don't particularly agree with a lot of it, with the act itself, as it stands. And maybe, you know, maybe that's done on purpose, you know what I mean, for you know, by design, I guess, to, you know, maybe somehow negotiate a way to make something like this work, you know, and how he actually anticipates it on working. But like, I can't help but feel that, you know, for something that's so well thought out, there are other things that probably need to be thought out more than this type of design around immigration. What it does is I believe it kind of feeds into that, you know, very right wing idea of, you know, we're Americans, you know, this is, you know, we buy American, we don't want to muddy the waters, you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like, you know, this is America and don't worry about the other countries, which is, you know, I get it. I get the whole idea of it, but now it's kind of like immigration is what created this country. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I have a small issue of, you know, really downplaying what people's skill set is coming into the country when they haven't had a chance to prove their skill set yet. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like,
but here's the thing, right? So if you don't have any standards when you're bringing people in from other countries, what happens is you're getting a lot of, or potentially a lot of, unskilled labor.
Sure.
Now, there's already a lot of unskilled laborers here in America that are out of jobs. So immediately what this thing is going to do, it's going to help people that are unskilled laborers because they're not going to have to compete against somebody who's an immigrant who may work for a lower wage or, you know, whatnot.
Of course.
So it's already kind of stemming that tide. So that's
I think
is good.
I totally get that. Like, it makes sense, right? I understand the premise of this, but keep in mind that, you know, the only reason the idea behind this RAISE Act almost seems to me, and maybe I'm reading it, okay, but it almost seems like it's only taking into account your value to our job, economy, okay, versus anything else. People don't just immigrate to other countries just for jobs or to raise their economy in terms of employment. You know what I mean? People come here for multitudes of other reasons. You know what I mean? They just might like the country. You know what I mean? Like, so, you know, if we're going to make the standard of, you know, look, we cannot bring immigrants in here because their work, you know, ethic or their employment, abilities are lower than our standard or higher than our standard, whatever it might be. Do we then take Americans that are here currently that have, you know, that score a negative 20 on this, you know, on this scale? Do we deport them? You know, like,
you think of this though. Two, I mean, a lot of people that are coming in from other countries, they have obligations to meet back home. Maybe they have a grandparent or an aunt or cousins or whatever. And they're going to be sending money from the United States that they're making in the United States. And they're going to be sending that overseas back to their country, potentially. Sure. When you hire American workers, that money is going to go directly back into our economy.
Mm-hmm.
you know, they're going to be buying goods and services and all this kind of thing. Not that the other people won't be doing that, but that's another benefit.
I'm sorry, Rich.
I was just going to say, I mean, I don't agree with Trump on quite a few things, but I think this is a really well thought out, really well intentioned thing. And I think also, and I don't mean to cut you off, what it's going to do, like I said before, it's going to get more people in America. It's going to decrease competition for jobs for Americans. So more Americans will be employed. And like I said, more money in our economy. We're going to keep, you know, American workers spending money in America. And also, shit, what was the third thing? God damn it.
Well, I don't mean to cut you off anyway. While you think of the third thing, another issue I see with this is, you know, there's a lot. So putting too much, I guess, like emphasis on something like this, right? Putting all this power into, you know, coming up with this RAISE Act, right?
Oh, the burden on our social programs.
Understood.
Welfare, SNAP, this and
so,
that.
There's two parts to that I would say is number one, a lot of the burden that we see is probably from illegal immigrants usually, right? I mean, I don't want to make a generalization here, but you know, a lot of that's not going to change. You know what I mean? Your illegal immigration is not going to change. You know what I mean? So, you know, unless there, you know, this wall is built and you have make all kinds of walls everywhere. You know what I mean? Like we're not just talking about Mexico here. We're talking about everywhere. So, you know, you're still going to have, you know, certain people that are lower skilled or taking money from our economy and sending it back home, you know, coming in. So I feel like number one, this might promote more illegal immigration rather than just going through the, you know, through the ropes, yeah. So to say, you know what I mean? To get in here legally, you know, because maybe I don't feel like I'm as skilled or whatever to get in there, but I know that I should. Another aspect of this is there's not, you know, it's cultural in a sense, but not all people come here, work here and send money back. In fact, I'd probably venture to say that most do not do that. And they spend the money in our economy in the way that our economy would love it to see it to spend its money, which is by, you know, purchasing goods and taxation and real estate tax. You know what I mean? Like, so, you know, the income tax thing could become an issue, but that's usually, you know, a thing with illegal immigrants anyway that don't want to be on the books in the first place. You know what I mean? So I don't really. And here's the other thing. The other aspect of this is by the time we would see a positive change in our economy on this, I mean, this would take a decade or more for us to actually reap any benefit from it. By that point, even if it's a half a decade, you know, by that point, somebody else is going to be president and they're probably going to overturn this. So is it worth all the energy that they're putting in?
And here's one final thing. Your dad came here in 19, you said 70 or 71. Mm-hmm. That year was like a very, or that decade was like a very low turnout for immigration in America. You know, it was like, I think that guy, I forget his goddamn name. What's his name, Joe? Jim.
Oh, Steve Miller?
Yeah, Steve Miller. I think he was saying there was maybe like 300,000 or something like that that came. So the year that your dad came is, and not that it's an outlier, but that's, I think, kind of what they're pushing for. They don't want a million people coming here.
So,
and burdening our already weak.
Two quick observations. Sorry, Rich, I didn't mean to cut you off. Only because
I didn't mean to interrupt either.
We're getting kind of far on the subject, but the two observations I think is funny. So we all agree it's a well thought out plan, but according to CNN, apparently it's highly modeled off of Australia and Canada. So maybe it's well thought out in that they you know looked at other countries and
well everybody copied. Wants us to be just like Canada and Australia anyway, right? So you know maybe
except
that's
for that.
And the second thing I think you know you guys both made some really good interesting points and arguments there. I think the one thing that we've kind of glossed over or didn't really address is the outcome of this really what we're all kind of alluding it to be, like, to limit it or whatever it might be. So consider this for Anthony's point, like, just because there's all these requirements, think about this in the context of your father too. So let's say these requirements were back then. Do you think your dad may have went out and tried to learn English before he came here, or maybe tried to get that certificate or something else that would help? You know what I'm saying? Like, maybe this is raising the bar.
I don't think they have the means to do that.
But maybe this is, but maybe this is more of a test. Like, so maybe it's not a if you think about a context of more of a, not quite a hurdle as much as it would be a test, right? Like, so if you really want to come to America, here's ways you could do it. So you could work on it. You know what I'm saying? And then you could get to it.
In terms of immigrants, and I can only use like my family, not even just my parents, but my other, you know, my cousins, aunts, uncles, you know, I can only use them as an example. But one of the things that I've learned over time is whether they, you know, came from Italy or Argentina or wherever they came from, Germany, you know, the best way for them to learn was through assimilation. You know what I mean? They didn't have the means to learn.
But think about,
and that's a great point.
Think about
a great point. Western Europeans are much more likely to assimilate to our culture than some other.
But also think about that concept in terms of there's the two requirements of age and education. Let's say these requirements were in place for your father. Your dad was 18. Maybe he saw that and go, well, I have a better chance if I'm 25 when I get the pretty much the highest points. And if I were to have a bachelor's degree and maybe if I spoke English. So you're thinking that this would have cut him off, but maybe your dad actually would have came here, I don't want to say, any better prepared, because your dad ended up being just fine, right? Obviously, but it would have just delayed him, in my opinion.
I
think your dad would have had that drive to want to come here because he wanted to come to America. So he probably
realistically though, like we're not talking about big cities that are in the know of any of this stuff. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like the RAISE Act, for instance, might not even be on anybody's radar. You know what I mean? And you know that you have these people. You know, my father, for instance, grew up in a town in Italy that nobody ever heard of, that was up on a mountain, that had, you know, a TV in the town square that they all went to every night to watch TV together. You know, they have rolling brownouts, they have no running water during the day. You know, these aren't a lot of the countries that people immigrate from, you know, the cities that they're coming from, they don't really have the ability to even have an understanding of what's even required to come over here. You know, he probably had somebody, you know, maybe his brother, my uncle, you know, say like, hey, you should come over here, it's kind of cool. You know what I mean? And okay, yeah, let's go. You know what I mean? Like they don't have any idea.
I mean, like, if he's so willing to make the trek to America, which is leaving the country, how hard is it to like travel south to like Venice, Rome, Bologna, whatever?
Yeah. I mean,
to meet the requirements.
The points are well taken. I think in this case, I think knowing your dad and the type of worker, hard worker he is, and the type of individual he is, I think this would have just delayed him because he would have gotten here. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think this kind of just raises the bar, right? The RAISE Act raises the bar, no pun intended.
I guess, and I don't want to prolong it too much, yeah, you know, but just a really quick thing is, or would it have made somebody like him decide to come here illegally, rather?
Or, it's a good point. Maybe try illegally, right? Good point. And in that case, maybe he's a good entrepreneurial spirit. He's taking the initiative there, right? Maybe that's another way of measuring.
And he'll get granted amnesty, and then everything will be fine.
Yeah, perfect. that's the positive spin on it, right?
Right, of course.
Oh, anyway, we've come to about 55 minutes or so. So we're not going to do the case study for now.
Good cast.
Great cast.
Really good cast.
So we'll do the case study on another cast, maybe on the live stream or something like that, if we want to do that. But we'll cut this off for now to keep us within Melissa limits.
Yeah, sorry, Melissa. I came late and I ended up prolonging the entire thing.
But you can find us on Twitter at No Name Podcast, or on Facebook at The Podcast Without a Name. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spreaker, Google Play.
Anchor.
Well, hopefully Anchor, right? We're going to talk about that, but that should be fun. Another, pretty much anywhere else you could get an iPod. Not an iPod. A podcast.
iPod.
iPods have been discontinued, so that will be
also around. You're only allowed to listen to our podcast if you're a 10 plus score on the RAISE Act.
That's true. So go to the RAISE Act.
You can find us in your hearts.
in your heart. The heart of hearts. So, all right,
guys. Thank you for letting me join.
Rich, you're gonna need the last words here. Ready? Hold on. Think about it. And last words, Rich.
Yo, roll. I'm gonna give it to you. We know trivia. We're like cocaine straight from Bolivia. No, I don't have any last words. I don't know what to say.
That was pretty good.
That's
though.
Good. I like that. I'll take
but,
that.
I like the Dream, the Rays Act, and I like you guys, and I like beer.